Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hi, everyone. My name is Andra Stanoyou, and you're listening to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio and Podcast. An estimated 2.6 million people in the UK suffer from ADHD. And yet, despite how common this is, many people still think it's just about being easily distracted or hyperactive. The symptoms of ADHD aren't very well known, which is why a significant majority of those suffering will never get a diagnosis or get the help they need. Dr. Adam Joyner is a UK-based doctor and medical lead for Psychiatry UK. He will educate us today about ADHD. He will help us understand what are the symptoms and how we can eliminate some of the myths around ADHD. Dr. Joyner, welcome to the Healthy Debate Show. How are you today?
Hello, thanks for having me. Yes, I'm great, thank you. I hope you're well too.
Absolutely. I'm very, very interested in today's show. We never spoke about ADHD in adults, so it's quite exciting to have you joining us. Please share with us some details about your professional background, your work.
Yeah, sure. So I trained as a doctor in London and then moved to the northwest of England, where I trained to become a psychiatrist, and I've worked as a consultant psychiatrist in various roles in the community, in various community mental health teams, and that was all mostly with the NHS, including in an adult ADHD service once upon a time. But now I'm the, as you mentioned, the medical lead with Psychiatry UK, which is currently the country's largest provider of adult ADHD services.
Dr. Joyner, why draw your attention towards ADHD? Do you have any, maybe family members, or did you notice that significant part of your clients were suffering from ADHD without them even knowing? Like, what drew you your attention towards ADHD?
So it was actually the sort of second option you gave me, really, where I noticed that in my general community mental health clinic that quite a few people probably had ADHD and were struggling with issues related to ADHD. And I recognized actually that it was something that I probably didn't know that much about and didn't really have the experience or knowledge to help people with. And so I essentially wanted to learn more about it so I could help people. And that's how I ended up working in an adult ADHD service. And that's how I developed my experience around ADHD, simply.
So let's start with the definition of ADHD. What is it, and what are some of the symptoms that adults can experience?
So, first of all, ADHD is what we would call a neurodevelopmental disorder. And what that means is that when the brain is developing in your early life, in early childhood, something happens, to put it basically, with the way that the brain is wired and the way it develops, that you will develop some certain difficulties in the way that you, for example, process information, which will be with you certainly throughout childhood and most likely throughout adulthood as well. So that's what we mean by neurodevelopmental disorder. And another sort of well-known neurodevelopmental disorder is autism, for example. But people who develop ADHD, they typically struggle with attention and focus, which can lead to some difficulties for them. Or they'll also experience hyperactivity, restlessness, and impulsivity, or they'll experience both of those things. And we can go into the exact symptoms of ADHD shortly, if that would be helpful. But essentially, something becomes ADHD when it's very persistent. It's there all the time, no matter what we're doing, and it adversely impacts on our life in some way as well. Because we all experience some inattentiveness and impulsivity from time to time, but it's only when it's persistent and adversely impacts on our life that it becomes a disorder.
We mostly speak about ADHD in children, and very rarely we bring forward the ADHD in adults. So what is the main difference or the main differences between these two?
We usually find that for adults who have ADHD, that they are typically more affected by the inattentive symptoms, and the hyperactivity is less obvious. And in fact, stereotypically, children with ADHD are, you know, perhaps disruptive in the classroom and have challenging behavior, whereas an adult with ADHD often experiences inner restlessness. So this constant feeling of needing to be on the go all the time, or their mind is constantly racing. You see it from time to time, but actually disruptive behavior is much less common in adults. And for most of my patients, I only see adults actually, but most of my patients, it really is only the inattentive issues that they really want help with.
I was saying at the beginning of our conversation that ADHD in adults is very rarely or not very often identified. What can we do to make sure that this gets early diagnosis? So the intervention will be sooner than later in life. What are some of the things that maybe parents should look for, or even adults should look for in observing their behavior?
That's an interesting question, because of course lots of people present very differently. So I think that one of the common themes that I see from adults who are seeking a diagnosis, certainly, is that they say that they've often started searching the internet. Why am I like this? Why am I so different from other people? Why am I struggling in ways that that other people seem not to struggle? So I suppose that would be the first thing that I would suggest that people think about. If you feel that you're struggling in some way, when you look around you and your colleagues and your family seem to manage life easily and you seem to struggle no matter what you do, it might not be that you have ADHD. There could be another reason that you are struggling, but ADHD might be a reason you're struggling. And whether you're for example a university student or you're in work or whatever, common ways you might be struggling is that you're struggling to stick to the deadlines that are required of you. When you sit down to try and do the work that's required of you. You just can't get started. You're very easily distracted. You seem to prioritize things that just quite frankly aren't as important as the task at hand. Or you start lots of different tasks and you can never quite complete them. These are the sorts of things that we typically see in adults. So those are the sorts of things that I would suggest looking out for. But like I said earlier, it is that persistence, and also whether or not you feel it's actually really starting to adversely impact on your life. Because actually, when you think about it, if you struggle to stick to tasks or meet deadlines, but actually for whatever reason, whatever it is, the way your life is set up, it doesn't matter if you can't do those things, then you don't really need to worry about, do I have ADHD and seek help and treatment. But if it's starting to really impact on your life, such that, for example, you might fail your university degree, or you might get sacked from your job or something like that, or your relationship might break down, then that would definitely be a reason to seek some help here.
You described very well how ADHD can impact your work life, your academic life, and you briefly touched on relationship. I'll be curious to understand a bit more about this aspect, about the impact of ADHD in relationships, how disruptive it can be.
Again, everyone's different, and for some people their ADHD won't, of course, adversely impact on their relationships, but it is something we do see in several patients. People with ADHD typically have more relationships. They sometimes describe, for example, that they get bored in relationships, and so they end things with their partner and seek a new relationship. Also, relationships can end the other way because sometimes partners struggle with the person with ADHD because they might be very impulsive or reckless. Maybe it's spending and buying things impulsively. It might be that they so often people with ADHD struggle to listen and as I said earlier, sort of complete tasks. So I've heard some wives and husbands say things like, let's say they've got two children, they'll say it's like having three children, because they feel that wife or husband with ADHD in the relationship is like a child, because they can't remember to do things, complete basic household chores, or if they do, then they seem to create more mess when doing it. And these kind of things can create friction in relationships when they're happening on a daily basis. So yes, it can cause issues, and it's becoming an emerging area around relationship help for people with ADHD, where there are people who are sort of setting themselves up to develop expertise in helping people specifically with ADHD who have relationship difficulties. It's not something I have expertise in, but that help is increasingly out there now.
So how is it diagnosed?
How is ADHD diagnosed? Simply put, it's diagnosed when an assessment is done by a consultant psychiatrist, and that assessment will be done against something called DSM-5 criteria. So DSM is Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and the 5 just means the 5th edition. It's quite a famous sort of book, I suppose. So that's how we will diagnose. We'll see our patients and we'll undertake an assessment against this DSM-5 criteria. We always look to try and get additional information from other people. So we'll of course spend most of our time with the person with suspected ADHD, but it's always useful to get information from someone who knows that person very well. The longer someone has known the person having an assessment, the better. So parents are the best person to provide additional information, but brothers and sisters and wives and husbands and things are sort of next best. Getting school reports as well is really, really helpful. I know for children, the process of assessment is much longer because it involves gathering information from schools. But for adults, it's not quite as lengthy as that. So when we do an assessment, we're asking quite a lot of questions. There are kind of 18 core symptoms of ADHD, although there are several other features and difficulties that are highly consistent with ADHD that don't feature in the DSM-5. I mentioned one of them already, which is like a very busy mind. So we'll always ask about those 18 core symptoms and whether or not they existed in adulthood and childhood, and we would need lots of examples of how they manifest. Another aspect of the diagnostic criteria is what age the symptoms started at. So if they started after the age of 12, then it's less likely that the difficulties are related to ADHD. We would look at the settings that the symptoms exist in as well, because let's say they only occur at work or only at home, then that makes it less likely someone's suffering with ADHD, and you'd be wondering about, well, what's going on in that particular environment that's making someone struggle if they can cope so well in other environments. Then we would look at whether or not the difficulties that the person being assessed describes are adversely impacting on their lives in some way, in such as it's impacting on their ability to function on a day-to-day basis. And then finally, we would look at whether or not there are other conditions that would actually better explain the difficulties that someone's come to see you about, because there are lots of psychiatric diagnoses which overlap. And sometimes we see people who come to you thinking that they probably have ADHD, but actually once you've done the assessment, you say, well, you probably have this other condition instead, or maybe as well as. That's how we do it in a nutshell.
So what are some of the other medical conditions that, overlap quite frequently?
Yeah, sure. Some of the personality disorders, in particular, there's one called emotionally unstable personality disorder, which can overlap, and some of the features overlap. There can be a lot of impulsivity, for example, and interpersonal difficulties in that disorder, as well as with ADHD. There are various mood disorders such as bipolar and cyclothymia as well, which can overlap with ADHD. In those conditions, when people are are experiencing higher moods, they can come across very hyperactive, impulsive, chatty, not focusing, all these kind of things that we often see in people with ADHD. They occur in some of those mood disorders as well. So those would be the two most common examples. People with ADHD are more likely to also experience things like anxiety and depression. Those wouldn't necessarily, you wouldn't necessarily say your difficulties are more likely to be due to anxiety or depression, but often they coexist. But I have seen one or two people who have been so anxious that they are restless and do struggle to focus and concentrate and things like that. So it can happen that even anxiety can mimic ADHD if it's severe enough and chronic.
My next question. Which one comes first? Are you first Do you first have ADHD and then you develop anxiety or depression, or is it the other way around? Because I'm thinking that living with ADHD is quite, it's not easy. So that's why I'm thinking about depression and...
Yeah, it's not easy. And like most conditions, you know, whether it's angina, pneumonia, what, you know, depression or ADHD, there's various levels of severity. So some people will have, you know, really severe ADHD where life is really, really difficult and challenging. And some people will be on the more mild end of things where it's, you know, present, but not completely debilitating. When you ask about what comes first, though, well, I mean, ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder, so it, you know, it starts to develop in childhood. Whereas, although anxiety can become chronic, it typically takes the pattern more of an illness where you have episodes, periods of your life where you feel you're suffering with significant anxiety, and then you recover. For example. However, a part of the diagnostic criteria of ADHD is that we rule out other conditions that might be causing ADHD. And actually, sometimes, and again, I can think of many patients I've seen where I think, I had this conversation with the patient where I say, yes, I think you do have ADHD, but you're also clearly suffering with, you know, something else, anxiety or depression. And actually, it's really, really difficult to fully assess whether or not you have ADHD until we adequately treat this other issue that you're experiencing. So we need to spend some time treating anxiety or depression or whatever else, and then revisit the ADHD after that.
Dr. Joyner, let's take a short break. And when we're back, I would like us to discuss in details about quite a few, I would say, interesting things. I would like to understand if people with ADHD maybe are prone to choose some specific professions, or what are the environments that are, in a way, stimulating more intense symptoms of ADHD. So we'll be back with Dr. Joyner.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
And we're back with Dr. Joyner. We're discussing ADHD in adults. Dr. Joyner, I was very curious before the break, are there any professions that people with ADHD tend to be more attracted to maybe study or follow?
There's no one or two things that I can think of. The estimated prevalence in adults of ADHD is around 2.5%. So that's a huge proportion of the population. And so within that 2.5% of the adult population with ADHD, pretty much every profession is covered. I do seem to have a lot of patients who are computer programmers, and I've absolutely no idea why that is, because actually, a job where you need to sit and focus on sort of very sort of I suppose mentally stressful job isn't
and repetitive, isn't it? Yeah,
doesn't necessarily lend itself to the sort of strengths of ADHD, and perhaps that's why I see more patients who are computer programmers come see me, because they actually struggle in that kind of profession, and then they tend to do better when they're on treatment. And then I suppose I always imagine, but of course, I'm afraid that I've got no proof or evidence to back this up, that people who perhaps take on slightly more active and hands-on jobs don't necessarily come and seek help because they don't need it, because they're actually coping much, much better in their environments. So, and I predict this partly because many of the patients who I see usually have kind of modern 21st century, you know, computer based jobs. But also, lots of my patients say things like they were very good at school with the more sort of practical practical subjects, the ones where you use your hands, like art and drama and woodwork and those kind of things. So I always imagine that patients who go into those kind of professions are probably less likely to seek help. And indeed, we do find, and certainly the ADHD community probably agree, that people with ADHD tend to be quite creative people. They tend to be very, tend to have quite a lot of social skills as well, and tend to have quite a lot of energy too. And so you actually find probably quite a lot of people who are entrepreneurs as well with ADHD, who are really good at meeting people and networking and sort of encouraging and motivating others. And they'll almost certainly succeed if they've got a very good PA and someone who can organize them. We've found many, many patients and people over the years who are in those sorts of situations where if they've got good support around them, they can thrive in all sorts of work environments. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
No, absolutely. I was very curious because mm-hmm. I was thinking about artists, people who are in creative industries that might be more they might find these industries satisfying enough, and you know, not very to put them under pressure. Mm. And it's interesting the example you've given us with the developers or IT, the people that are working in the IT area. Now, I'm also curious about the social environments. Are there any specific environments that are posing a difficulty for people with ADHD? For example, big crowds, or is there anything like that that might maybe make the symptoms worse?
Well, I think for people who only have ADHD, I would probably say no. So people with ADHD tend to be very sociable and manage quite easily with large crowds. Although, like anyone with or without ADHD, you might have some kind of social phobia and therefore struggle with large crowds. But that might not necessarily be because of the ADHD. But a lot of people with ADHD also have autism, and I find that a lot of my patients with autism and ADHD, they would struggle in those environments, but that's probably because of their autism, not because of their ADHD. So people who just have ADHD certainly and no autism, yeah, they on the whole, you know, again, everyone's different, but on the whole, those people tend to be find social environments and crowds quite easy to manage, generally speaking. Yeah.
What are some of the stigma? What is some of the stigma around ADHD? What are some of the things that maybe your patients come forward with, like the myths around it and, you know, the legends around ADHD?
Yeah, I think the main one, there's always a few, but the main one that I see most often is sort of stigma of laziness, or the myth of laziness. So people can often come and talk about how they've throughout their kind of careers, which include both their, you know, school life when they were children and then into their adult careers and their marriages and things like that, that they've always been told that they're lazy, and they've always said, I know I'm not lazy, I just seem to just struggle to get things done, I just always get distracted and never do the task at hand, never do what I say I was going to do, and never complete what I was going to do. But, you know, what I described then are very common ADHD difficulties and symptoms. So there's this, so they can often be told they're lazy, and kind of that lifelong criticism is sometimes what you know, nibbling away is sometimes what leads to, or can certainly contribute to, the anxiety and depression we often see in people with ADHD as well. So laziness is a really is a really big one. People who are very hyperactive, you know, they could sometimes people say that others have always thought that they're perhaps high on drugs or something like that, and they can suffer various stigma if they have some, you know, one of the severer forms of hyperactivity. So I see that sometimes, but you know, like we were talking about earlier, the hyperactivity isn't such a common issue in adults as inattentiveness. So, but yeah, but laziness is a really common one. Yeah.
What is the treatment available for ADHD?
Yeah. So we follow something called NICE guidelines in the UK. We do that you know, across medicine, you know, whether you go and see a surgeon about you know, your arthritis, or whether you see your psychiatrist about ADHD, there'll be some NICE guidelines. NICE guidelines essentially set up guidelines which summarize the current available evidence for best treatment, but also the some of the most, you know, economically viable treatment options as well. And what the guidelines recommend for adults is actually that the first treatment is something called environmental modification. Now, it isn't entirely clear what that means, but generally what we believe it means is keeping a diary, setting reminders. If you're a student, for example, doing your studying somewhere quiet and distraction free, those kind of things, you know, that's kind of what it means, really. When we see patients for the first time, 99.9% of the time, people have already tried these things, and that's why they're seeking help. So when we do see them, the next thing that NICE guidelines recommends is medication. And actually, medication is very effective for most people with ADHD. Not everyone. It's not going to work for everyone, but it's very effective for most. And broadly speaking, there's two types of medication, what we call stimulants and non-stimulants. Stimulants tend to be more effective and for more people, and that's why they're used first. They are a controlled drug, though, so we have to, you know, there's various restrictions on how it's prescribed and how much it can be prescribed. But that would typically be the first treatment, and then the non-stimulants would be used if stimulants either weren't tolerated or weren't effective for someone, or they have a medical condition, for example, that means that they're ineligible to have stimulants. Then there's an increasing number of non-pharmacological treatments becoming available out there, various therapies and coaching. There's probably a lack of evidence as to its effectiveness, although evidence is increasing. It's certainly in the UK, non-pharmacological treatments are not yet routinely available on the NHS for people with ADHD. But certainly, I know several patients that, for example, have paid to have some sessions with an ADHD coach to help them learn how to organise themselves, and they found that helpful for them. Those kind of things are becoming increasingly available, and I suppose, like most things, if you know, if people want to try them and they're helpful for them, then they should.
How long do people need to have the treatment for? Is it for life, or does it all depends on how severe the ADHD is?
It depends on how severe and on other factors. So, everyone's again, everyone's different. And people want to stop medications for different reasons. Some people just don't like the idea of taking medication. They've told me that they want to stop it. They think that they can cope without. They think they can put enough of these, for example, environmental modifications in place that they don't need medication. And that's absolutely fine, not a problem. There was some data published, I think it was in America, and I think it was 3 or 4 years ago now, that found that about 90% of adults with ADHD had stopped their medication within 10 years. What we're not clear about, though, is whether or not they stopped it because they didn't need it, or they stopped it because they just sort of disengaged with the clinic where they were getting their follow-up and treatment, or a combination of both. So certainly my experience is that most people will come off medication at some point. It seems to be that being on medication allows people to learn the skills that they, you know, require to function. In a way, the brain kind of rewires through practice, day in, day out, for years on end, and then it gets to the point where they don't need medication often. Of course, I have patients that are the other way around, where every few years they find that unfortunately they need a higher dose of medication because their current medication is no longer working. And every 2-3 years we have to increase the dose a little bit. So everyone's different, and it's hard to predict.
Should everyone be treated?
No, is the short answer.
A bit unexpected.
Yeah, exactly. So not everyone should be treated. I think that patients and doctors should always ask the question, yeah, how severe is it? Because, you know, these medications, all medications, and certainly medications for ADHD, have potential risks, have potential side effects, and shouldn't be used, without much consideration or thought. And so if someone has ADHD and doesn't need medication, they can function and manage and find other ways, then that is better. That is preferable. That is what we want. But that's probably true for everything, whether or not you have arthritis or asthma. If you need medication, that's the only way you're going to, in some instances, survive, or in some instances thrive, then of course you should take it. But if it's something that only makes a very small difference or no difference at all, then you probably shouldn't take it. Yeah.
Dr. Joyner, let's take a short break now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And we're back with Dr. Joyner. We're discussing ADHD in adults. Dr. Joyner, are there any benefits of having ADHD?
Well, yes, and we discussed some of them earlier. So often people with ADHD can be more creative. They can have more energy. They can seemingly achieve things that other people without ADHD would struggle to achieve. I think of some of my colleagues with ADHD and the energy they have and the way they seem to be able to keep going sometimes and show another level of enthusiasm for things. I can sometimes look on quite enviously. So there are many benefits, I'm sure people with ADHD are probably even better placed than me to describe some of those benefits that have been experienced or witnessed. And I suppose increasingly we hear this term neurodiversity, which is about, you know, accepting people and their differences, you know, whether it's because they have ADHD or autism or something else. And it's true, and there are many strengths and benefits to having these disorders and being different from other people. And I sometimes find that when back before the break, we were talking about should everyone be treated, and I sometimes find people who have treatment say things like that they don't feel as creative when they're taking their treatment. Yes, they can, you know, complete their tax return more easily or whatever, but they don't feel as creative. They don't feel they can achieve some of the things they used to be able to achieve. And but you know, in those kind of instances, you've got to start doubting whether or not medication is right for someone. So it's always going to depend on individual circumstances, who you are, who you interact with, what sort of other environments you exist in, what jobs you have, what you need to achieve in life. Those are all the things to consider when thinking about treatment or not.
Do you have any examples where you worked with your patients and the results were really great and you've noticed significant changes in the person's life?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, I mentioned earlier that for some people, medication doesn't work at all, and that's true. And then you get the other end of the spectrum where I have some patients that call the medication life-changing, or they say things like the difference between being on medication and not is like night and day. Some people feel that they just wouldn't be able to function or exist or have successful, healthy, happy life without medication. So I've seen some real successes. Some successes might be just reaching an individual's potential in their chosen job or career. Or I've seen some successes where people were unfortunately had, you know, a history of some significant criminal behavior, often through sort of impulsivity and anger associated with their ADHD, but their medication was so effective that they were able to just completely control that, and since being on medication have, you know, never committed a crime or been in a fight or anything like that since. And so those are some not only does that really help the individual live a fulfilling life, but that has societal positive impacts as well. And of course, we're talking about the extremes here. You know, the people who experience life-changing benefits, the people who don't get any benefit at all. But we have to remember that, you know, the sort of 50 or 60% majority in the middle will experience some benefit. Usually, oh yes, I find I'm not so distracted and I can focus more easily and gather my thoughts and be a bit more organized. So they definitely get benefit, but they might not necessarily describe it as life-changing.
I know you work for Psychiatry UK. Please tell us a bit more about the organization and how they can help if there is someone out there listening to us suffering from ADHD.
Yeah. So Psychiatry UK is an entirely online organization providing psychiatric assessments and treatment. So it's a convenient way to see a consultant psychiatrist, where you can see them at home from your computer or whatever device you have. We actually originally started off as a company for private patients who are paying for their own private healthcare. But the majority of our work is now done through the NHS, supporting the NHS. So if you live in England, we have several contracts to provide the adult ADHD service for some places in England. But if you live outside of one of those contracted areas, you can still access our service through something called Right to Choose. And if you go to our website, if you just Google Psychiatry UK, you'll find our website, and there's information about accessing our service through Right to Choose. if you feel that you have ADHD or that you might have ADHD and you want to you want an assessment or to get some help, the way to do it in all of the UK is to go and speak to your GP and ask for a referral. Obviously that might be to your local NHS ADHD service, and it might end up being referral to us at Psychiatry UK. Currently, we're unable to see people outside of England for the NHS, but we will be able to see people outside of England for private healthcare after the new year at some point.
Dr. Joyner, thank you so much for your time today. I very much appreciate you took the time to explain to us what ADHD in adults is. We discussed about the social stigma around it. We discussed about various treatment options and how ADHD people can live a good life. That was my understanding, that depending on the severity of the symptoms, they can have a good life. So thank you very much for your time, and I wish you best of luck with your work in Psychiatry UK and everything that you're planning to achieve in the next years.
Thanks very much for having me.
Until next time, may we hear only good things.